We got one more guest here for this Wednesday edition of Bang the Book Radio. That is Wes Reynolds, at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, man?
Hi, Adam. Doing well. How about yourself, sir?
Doing very well, bud. Appreciate the time as always, man. Thank you so much for joining me. And we haven't had a whole lot of basketball talk on the show over the last couple of weeks with the NFL playoffs going on and obviously the national championship game as well. We'll get to basketball in a second, but I want to ask you the same question that I've been asking all of our guests here, crowdsourcing some opinions about this. College football season has wrapped up. So as you look back at the season that you had, Wes, in college football, what do you feel like you did really well? What do you feel like was very effective for you this year?
You know, I guess, what I think I did well was, finding some different underdogs and maybe, being able to find different situational spots in certain aspects. I mean, I haven't really had the time to take like a full assessment of it because you're going right into another season. So there's really not a lot of breaks when a season winds down. But I mean, you know, learning and I think also learning to that not everything has parity. I mean, the good teams are good teams. And I mean, you know, not being afraid, I guess, in certain aspects to lay a big favorite, even though, you know, that's not what you want to do, I guess, every single week because the odds makers eventually catch up. But I mean, you know, some of these teams, I mean, these teams like Clemson and Alabama, a lot of times these teams get to be big favorites for reasons. And I mean, you saw, you know, ordinarily looking at some of the instincts, you know, your instinct when a team wins a few in a row is to just fade it. And, you know, I mean, like when Clemson lays a bunch of big points to Louisville or somebody like that. So, you know, this year I guess I learned to kind of either go with it or stay away from it instead of automatically saying, oh, that's way too many points. Well, I got to take the underdog because that's what I've always done. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you got to learn when to get in front of a team on a streak and, you know, when to stay away and just, you know, pass on the game.
So obviously the flip side here, and again, you'll take more of an assessment of your college football performance as time permits. I mean, it's obviously, like you said, you know, we jump basically now everyone's focus is college basketball. You still have the NFL and the NHL and the NBA going on. So still a lot of things going on here, but you know, in terms of looking at your college football results and thinking back to how the season played out for you, what do you feel like you could have done better or that maybe you'll look to incorporate a little bit more next season?
I think maybe, you know, in terms of like timing, you know, being willing to, you know, play something really early in the week, whether it's Monday, and anticipating a move, a line move a little bit quicker, and then at the same time being willing to be patient and not getting involved too early, you know, waiting until the end. I mean, I guess an example would be like the national championship game. You know, if you like the under and you played it right away, you at least probably got a push out of it since it opened around 60. But if you waited and took 59, which wasn't a bad number, considering it went down as low as maybe 56, 56 and a half at certain spots, you know, you lost. So, I mean, you know, it's just kind of, you know, getting more of a knack and I guess learning and anticipating line moves. So, you know, if you have an opinion, I mean, you know, don't wait on it. I mean, I had somebody ask me because I played under 59. That was one of the best. I did lose on the game, but got it back, you know, at least to break even with the second half. But, you know, somebody asked me, oh, don't you think this is going to go up? And it never really did. You know, it never reached that level of 60, what it was when the line came out. So, I mean, you know, I think if you like something, you know, you got to jump on it instead of just always waiting.
All right, let's transition over to the hardwood here, and I want to talk a little bit of NBA with you, Wes, because, you know, one of the things I do a lot of situational handicapping when it comes to the NBA and the NHL, largely because I write the articles over at bangthebook.com, and it kind of gives me a starting point, gives me an idea here of what to do with some of these teams. And, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about here lately, and I actually looked at some results here today, it's the dog days of winter. You know, the NBA and the NHL seasons get very monotonous at this point in time because it's just the same old, same old. You know, the good teams are the good teams, the bad teams are the bad teams. You travel to one place in the dark, you leave that place in the dark, you head to another place, or you know, you're home with your family or whatever else. The excitement of the start of the season is gone, and the excitement of the playoff chase isn't really there yet. So my thought would be, I would be inclined to look at underdogs in those types of situations. As it turns out here this season so far, underdogs only 21-36 against the spread. Last year they were 110-97-2, looking only at the month of January here. But, you know, Wes, I mean, when you look at the NBA here at this time of the year, what is sort of your starting point? What are you kind of looking for? Here's a lost Wes Reynolds here on the show. We'll have to go ahead and get him back in a couple of seconds here. But again, I do just want to explain real quickly, kind of talking over my words a little bit there. That's 21-36 against the spread for underdogs in the month of January, and then 110-97-2 in the month of January last year, 110-106-4 in 2017, 95-122-5 in 2016. So in terms of looking at underdog performance in the NBA here in the month of January, and you know, it's good to be able to look back at these results and kind of do some, you know, really for lack of a better term, self-myth busting, I think, when it comes to, you know, some of these thoughts that we have, some of these situational angles that we're looking at and considering here, you know, when it comes to the NBA, the NHL, whatever the case may be, we get these narratives in our minds. We get this idea, you know, of how things should be, of what we would expect things to be. And then as you actually look into the results, sometimes that's not going to be the case. And I think that that's something a little bit here as it pertains to the NBA, you know, as I'm kind of looking at where I would think that in the month of January, you know, that that dogs would be a better play. But as it turns out, seems like that may not really be the case here. So, you know, it's one of those things where, again, you're always trying to figure out what matters to you, what can be proven, what can't be proven, something like that. And so I think that when you kind of myth bust some of these things in the NBA or in any sport, really, it's really beneficial for you. So see if we got Wes back on the line here. Wes, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Good to get you back on the line here. And as I was talking about while you were trying to call back in there, I would have thought that underdogs would be a pretty obvious way to look in the month of January, because you've got people that are transitioning from college football in the NFL to betting the NBA. They're going to want to bet the teams that they can trust. So you'd figure those lines are shaded or inflated a little bit. Seems like overall, you know, that's not really the case. It seems like it's either a pretty even split between dog or favorite, or like this year, the favorites are having a field day.
Yeah. And I mean, And I mean, you know, we talk about tanking, you know, that it's kind of become a little bit of maybe not necessarily a way of life, but it does exist. Now, you know, when you're thinking tanking, you know, it's not like players are just going out there and just necessarily not trying. But, you know, some of these teams, I think, have been made so bad and constructed so badly on purpose that, I mean, that these teams are going to lose games. And, you know, some of them have been worse than others. I mean, like, you look at a team like Cleveland, where you're like, okay, they're in a good spot. Now, last night they did come back and backdoor the Pacers. But the Pacers got out to, like, almost a 30-point lead or something. And you know, they probably let the foot off the gas and knew they had the game in hand. But, you know, it is a lot tougher. It has been for me specifically to find those type of spots where you're going to see a favorite kind of, you know, seemingly, you know, not necessarily mail it in, but I think, you know, not really have their best effort. I mean, so I think it's been hard to find those spots. And I think, you know, part of it is this is the second year with this schedule starting so early where it doesn't start Halloween or November 1st, where it's starting in the middle of October. You know, the All-Star break, I mean, we're really, with some teams that are halfway through their season, like, you know, the All-Star break should be now, but it's not for another month. And, you know, until after the Super Bowl. So they're playing the bulk of the season like before the All-Star break instead of, you know, where you know, you have the NHL or you have Major League Baseball where it's like, okay, at the halfway season, that's when we're going to take the All-Star break. But they're not necessarily doing that here. And, you know, it's thrown a little bit of the dynamic off, and I think the scheduling has made it a little bit harder to find these spots that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it has too. I mean, I did a video over on our YouTube page for Bang the Book yesterday with my Tuesday 3-pack and went 2-1 on those games, had Atlanta in the NBA because that was a bad spot for Toronto. Coming off of a lot of big games, and then all of a sudden you're a 2-touchdown favorite against the Hawks. But, you know, I was talking with Kyle Hunter about, you know, going over the plays I wanted to use on the video, and I was looking at Golden State. And Golden State was a 17-point favorite. Now, Golden State has not been a great team covering really big double-digit numbers over the last little while. But New York was wrapping up a 6-game trip. They haven't played a home game since Christmas. They're going back home for a quick stop before they go play in London. I thought it was a horror spot for New York. But, you know, laying 17, obviously very difficult to do, even no matter how good Golden State is. But that's the thing, is that, you know, in the past, I probably would have fired right away on Golden State, you know, and just been like, you know what, I'm not that worried about the number. I believe this much in the spot. But, you know, by contrast, you mentioned a team like Cleveland. I've lost several times on Cleveland this year thinking, oh, the Cavs are in a really good spot here, you know, playing Indiana in a sandwich spot like last night's was, or, you know, some team that's playing, you know, Boston or Toronto or somebody after them. Ah, Cleveland should be in a good spot here. And then they're just not. And I feel like, you know, the problem is that there are so many teams that are really good and that have to worry about home court advantage and what the importance of that is now, that I think that a lot of coaches are actually able to get through to these guys and say, you know what, all 82 games matter. And I feel like it didn't used to be that way.
No, not at all. And I think that this is a tough part of the season. I mean, I didn't have an NBA play last night, and it's like, you know, it's like I want to put the time into it, but I mean, you get so many numbers, and I think the fact that so much of analytics and all that stuff has come in a little bit more to basketball. You know, I think the guys that are probably doing the best in the NBA are really, you know, the numbers guys that put a lot more full time into this. I mean, I know a lot, you know, some guys that are much better in the NBA and don't really do a lot with college basketball. And I just think, like, the NBA is harder. And I'm like, how do you do it? I mean, but different people have different strengths and weaknesses in their respective ways they do handicapping. But, yeah, I mean, I think that it's difficult. I mean, I think that, you know, by and large, I mean, the way that they lay out games for the season, I mean, you know that Tuesday and Thursday nights, they're usually – going to have less games. You know, Wednesday is going to be the majority of the teams playing, Friday, and then as they go into the weekend, and Thursday night is a small schedule because of the national TV doubleheader on TNT. But, you know, the going back to the scheduling dynamics, you know, I just think that it makes it more difficult. And I know that they've tried to eliminate the back-to-backs. While that's good for the players and good for the organizations and the franchises, it's not as good for us because there's not as many of those, what you would call the traditional NBA spots. There's not as many 4 and 5s and 5 and 7s and back-to-backs with this lengthened schedule and really starting it earlier.
You mentioned something, and again, I mean, this is a topic that we could spend an entire show on. The way to do it now across all sports markets is to be a modeler. It is to be analytics driven, because it's very hard to argue with data. You know, I mean, there's a lot less gray area when it comes to data or modeling or something like that. When you talk about these situational spots, over the long term, are they going to be profitable? Probably. Will they be as profitable as they would have been 10, 15 years ago? Probably not. I don't have the time or the capability or the systems to model everything and put in all of this analytics and all that kind of thing. It's why I think baseball is my best sport, because I've had an intricate knowledge of sabermetrics for over a decade now. I've been applying them for a long time. I know how to interpret the numbers, know how to use them, know what I want to do. But, you know, when it comes to the NBA and the NHL, I mean, I don't have that stuff. I don't have the models. I don't have time to put that stuff together. So I do fall back on the crutch of the situational spots, and they're unquantifiable. There's no absolutes to them. Should they work? Maybe. Do you think they're going to work? Probably. Do they always work? No. And you can value all of these spots differently, whereas if you're handicapping strictly from a data subset, you can't argue with that as much. And it makes the process so much easier, because you just look at it and say, okay, my numbers say this, I'm going to play this. But if you don't have that capability, you're doing that situational analysis. It takes a lot of time. It's frustrating for me, because I want to be on the cutting edge as much as possible, but I have limitations from a time standpoint, you know, from just an understanding of NBA analytics standpoint. It's hard. And like you said, I think it really is those data savvy types of guys that really are having the most success these days, because the tried and true methods are losing some of their value.
Right. And I'm the same way. I wish I could do that too, but I mean, I don't have the capability. I don't think I'm unintelligent, but I don't have that particular intelligence to, you know how to set up a math model or know how to set up an algorithm that, you know, is going to punch out the numbers, where it makes it a hell of a lot easier to, you know, to find winners, or to, you know, kind of, did not include certain games and, you know, be able to pass on them and kind of throw them away. You know, I wish that I could do that, but I mean, it's just, you know, that's the thing. I mean, some people have the more time to do that. I know myself lately, I have even less time than I had before. So, I mean, I'm having to try to figure it out, and you're figuring it out as you go along, to kind of, you know, see how you can do handicapping, because I mean, I'm at the point too where I'm not in front of a Don Best screen all day, and I can't really monitor these, you know, second by second, minute by minute, hour by hour. So a lot of times I have to get in stuff a little bit earlier, but I mean, you know, that's all part of it, man. And that's all part of the challenge is being able to find a way to do that. Sometimes, you know, the way you learn lesson is sometimes you lose some bets and you got to lose some games to kind of figure out where your balance and your equilibrium is.
Well, and that's not to say that you have to be a modeler to have success at this, because I know people that have had long-term success that are not modelers. But, you know, it certainly does help to have that level of data. And if you don't have it, like most of our listeners, like you and I, you know, there are still a lot of things you can do in terms of understanding the markets, understanding what drives them, understanding what line moves mean. And then, of course, you know, doing that research and you know, finding those edges, finding the stats that matter to you, the situational spots, all those types of things. It's just that you have to work a lot harder and maybe not as efficiently as some of the modelers. So if you're somebody starting out in this and you really want to be successful at this, I would recommend putting in that time to do the modeling stuff if you have it. If you don't, you know, then use a lot of – you have to compile a lot more things, I think, to really put you over the top on a play. You can't just look at a spot and say, well, this is the fourth road game in 6 days, I'm going to play this automatically. You know, you just use that as one part of the handicap and one part of a much larger process.
Right. And I mean, you know, and we know nowadays in the essence or how, you know, setting lines works now. I mean, it's not, like the old days where different guys had different numbers, whether it was based on their action or whether it was based on just the odds maker opinion. Now a lot of it, there's not a lot of origination. Now a lot of it is, you know, copy paste with the lines, and you just don't see the line variances. I mean, you know, you're not going to see, I mean, like in college basketball, you're not going to see one book have a total of 145 and another book have a total of 151 on the same game. You're just not going to have that because these odds makers now are interested primarily in limited liability. And, you know, they're not putting as much gamble in the line maybe as they used to.
All right, so let's transition and talk college basketball for a couple of minutes here because we're deep in the heart of conference play now at this point in time. A lot of teams have played at least two or three conference games. Some of them have played more than that. I think you and I have touched on this before, but, you know, for any of our listeners that missed any episodes or segments during the holidays or anything of that sort, conference play, students are back on campus, so home court advantages go back to normal. Does anything change in your handicapping process right now in college basketball, Wes?
There's a couple things that change, and I actually, interestingly enough, just did a little kind of short basic piece for a site called BetterIQ.com, where you have some guys that have their plays available for purchase, but these are guys that aren't necessarily what I would call pick sellers. These guys are professional bettors that put their cash and back their opinions at the window. But I'm basically writing some content for them. And the first article I wrote, which I'm going to tweet out later today, was about the kind of the different nuances in conference play and what you have to look at. And one useful tool, I think, of looking at that, at least especially early on in the season before the numbers maybe get a little bit tighter as you have more games and as you get into February and March, is that you got to look a little bit, especially not as much with what I would call the Power Six conferences, but as you get to the mid-major, the lower mid-major, and then the lower major conferences, you really want to look at scheduling, the non-conference scheduling in some of these games. I mean, and you can look at anything, you know, whether it's KenPom, whether it's Jeff Sagarin, or any of these other guys that do power ratings, and really looking at the schedule and looking at who these teams are playing. I mean, the most pronounced example is in the SWAC with Texas Southern, and we talked about them before, you know, when Mike Davis was notorious for doing that. I mean, playing all these road guarantee games, not just for the money, but also for preparing a team for non-conference, because when you've been playing the Oregons and the Gonzagas and the Baylors and the Kentuckys, I mean, this year Texas Southern got wins on the road at Oregon and Baylor and another place. So, I mean, but when you're playing those teams, all of a sudden playing Alcorn State doesn't seem like that much of a challenge. And you know, you have to look, I think, at non-conference scheduling. You have to look at different styles of play. I mean, we know that the style of play, like in the Big Ten, is going to be a little bit more physical than it is maybe in some other conferences. And then looking, you know, one example I found this year with tempo is the Big West has nine teams, and I believe six of the nine teams rank up in the bottom 50 or 60 in tempo. And then you have a couple outliers with Cal State Northridge and Cal State Fullerton that rank out of 353 some teams that rank, you know, in the top 40 to 50 in tempo that really want to get a lot more up and down. So you're looking at styles of play. You're looking also at new coaches that sometimes it takes a non-conference season for a new coach to get a system in place. Sometimes it even takes a full year because you need to have the personnel. And an example I used in the article was Charlotte, who had been running and gunning and going more up-tempo with Mark Price and then interim coach Houston Fancher. Well, now they have Ron Sanchez, who has spent the last 12 years at Washington State and Virginia under Tony Bennett. So he's trying to instill a pack line and slowing the tempo a little bit more on offense when he has doesn't necessarily have all of his personnel that he and his staff have recruited. So with a team like that, it's probably going to take more than a dozen games in the non-conference to really, you know, to really be able to do that. And that's why people often say a team with a new coach is going to make its most improvement in the second year. because they've had a year to kind of go through the growing pains. So, I mean, styles of play is another factor. I mean, there's the obvious factors that we look at for every game, no matter what time of the season, with injuries or, you know, and then some kids that might get eligible if they're midseason transfers for second semester or they had some kind of academic issue. So really knowing with those teams. But, I mean, I think those are really the factors that you look at, because the familiarity factor is also another one, because most of these conferences, except, you know, the super conferences where you got like the ACC, where you got a team from Boston and a team from Miami in the same damn conference. Most of these teams, the teams in the conferences, they're near each other in a geographic area. And as you get lower, as you get from the power conferences to the lower conferences, a lot of these schools recruit the same talent. And so they're familiar with each other. So you're not going to see necessarily the talent gap in the Big West. You know, there's not going to be a real big talent gap between like a UC Irvine and a, or something like that. I mean, well, whereas like last night you saw a talent gap, even though they barely covered at the end, they barely covered the closing line. There's a talent gap between Duke and Wake Forest in the ACC, but it's less pronounced in these other conferences. And there's also, you know, the familiarity, but the fact that you play these teams every year, you know what these teams are going to run, you know, what to be more prepared for than if you're playing some non-conference team in some random holiday tournament.
One other thing I want to mention there, and you mentioned a lot of great points, but you talk about strength of schedule differences. Really, for the first time I can remember, we've got market-wide numbers for the America East Conference, the Atlantic Sun, the Big South, the MEAC, the SWAC. You know, a lot of times these used to be added games that only some sportsbooks would put up. Now all of the sportsbooks offshore, and probably a lot in Vegas, putting up all of these numbers. So that's where you can really find some enormous strength of schedule mismatches that, you know, previously didn't matter until the conference tournaments, but now matter in the regular season as well. Wes, I know you got to get going here, so I just want to ask for a couple more minutes looking at the Sony Open in Hawaii, out in Honolulu, back-to-back Hawaii events here. We got a good primer on this event yesterday with Brian Blessing and some of the guys that he's looking at for that tournament. Who are some of the guys that you're thinking about for the Sony Open?
Well, one guy I did go back to that I actually played last week, and he finished tied for fourth, so he got there if you're an each way better, or if you're a top five, top 10 guy, was Mark Leishman. And, you know, I know that's actually, knowing Brian, I know Mark Leishman. I don't know if he picked him yesterday, but I know that that's one of the guys he usually kind of gravitates towards. And, you know, he plays well, and he's in a bit of good form. And he's a guy that played a lot of golf in the dog months of winter, played in Australia, went home and, you know, finished second to finished second with his partner, Cameron Smith, at the World Cup of Golf, and then finished second to him at the Australian PGA, also won in Malaysia. So he's on some good form, really didn't get to make a big move on the weekend. He was too far back, but, you know, he's a guy that I like here. And, you know, this is an event, even though Justin Thomas won it as kind of a chalky price at 14-1 a couple years ago, and certainly is the favorite this year, this is an event where you could go a little bit off the radar, and I'm just trying to give a couple guys. I can't give all the guys I played in the essence of time, but one guy I looked at, I liked Sungjae Im, who is around probably 70 or 80-1 now. The kid that won the Web.com to a regular season money list last year and actually started the season finishing first and second, because the Web.com tour starts in the Bahamas. And so he's, I think, really adept at playing in some tropical climates. So he was the guy I looked at. I also looked at Oliver Snyderjans at 125-1. Different angle this year. He's got a new caddy on the bag this year, and it's Damon Green, who, if you really follow golf closely, you know that he's been with Zach Johnson for the past 15 years, and they split. And, you know, I think Green thought he needed a break. Zach Johnson thought he needed a more permanent change. But, you know, Zach's a guy that's played really well on this course in the past. So I think that course knowledge could help Ollie here. So I liked him. There were a couple other mid-price guys I liked. Like, Bubba Watson at 40-1, even though he was terrible on the greens last week. But I just think that was more of a numbers thing, because, I mean, he went up to 50-1. I mean, last week he was in the 25-30. I mean, that was a smaller field. But, you know, sometimes you get these little overreactions week to week. I mean, you know, you're looking at somebody like Gary Woodland, who played well here in the past but hasn't won. But, you know, he was right there to win last week. And then, you know, now he's like 14, or, you know, he's the same price as Jordan Spieth. And I don't think Gary Woodland is the caliber of player Jordan Spieth is. And, you know, so you get those little market reactions, and that's something I think you want to pay attention to in the course of the season, because when a guy plays well one week, the price immediately gets cut. And it's like you're losing so much value week to week. So that's something I think you should pay attention to.
Well, I like it. Of course, Brian mentioned Sungjae Im yesterday, and we did talk a little bit about Leishman as well. So, you know, hearing some of the same names certainly helps between these two golf segments that we have. Wes Reynolds, you can follow his work on Twitter at Wes Reynolds and the number one. Appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
No problem. Always good chatting with you.